You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we are going to be talking to Bryn Nelson. He's an author, a journalist, and an editor, and he has just completed a fascinating new book called Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. Now, while you are thinking about what that treasure may be, I'll say, hi, Bryn, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Bryn's writing specializes in the environment, medicine, travel, and science, and everything is in this book. Let's start with this book is described by the New York Times as a comprehensive study of human waste. That's the treasure. And it explores the possibilities for global health inside every flesh. So I love something I saw about this book. The title was What Can Poo Do For You? And so that's
right. Right.
Yeah, I thought that was great. Was that your idea, Bryn?
I worked with my editor on that, but we had a lot of fun with the pun possibilities here.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So let's start with tell us about you and what is it in your background that led you to write about the benefits of human waste?
Sure. So my background is I was trained as a microbiologist at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I decided that I much preferred writing about science than actually doing it. So I switched careers and went through the University of California at Santa Cruz science writing program and trained to become a journalist. So I have written about science and the environment and health and medicine for the last 20 plus years. And, you know, the gut microbiome always fascinated me as a microbiologist. And about 8 years ago, I did a feature story about something I think we'll probably talk about later in the segment on FMTs, transplants. And it just got me really excited about the possibility of this waste product, as we've always thought of it, as having this incredible potential to do good if we kind of rethink, you know, what we thought we knew about it and make sure that we are treating it with respect because it can be harmful, but also, you know, reconsidering the many different ways in which it can help us, from medicine to in the environment. Yeah. And so I just got really obsessed with the idea of this, and it kind of snowballed from there and turned into a book project.
It really did. So that's what where your interest came from. And in the very first chapter, you're talking about the substance itself. What's important about the matter, especially phosphorus? And we all know that human waste has a lot of bacteria and microbes in it. How can that possibly be beneficial?
Right. So it also has a lot of nutrients in it. And so phosphorus is one of the nutrients. Nitrogen is another nutrient. And these nutrients are very important. They're essential for plant life. And nature has this very efficient recycling system that reuses phosphorus and has so for millions of years. One of the things that I thought was really fascinating when I was digging into this is researchers have actually implicated very large animals, megafauna, they refer to them as. So things like woolly mammoths, saber-toothed cats, mastodons, that were actually really important in this recycling system. So they would actually recycle many of these nutrients, not only through their bodies, but also through their poop, through their dung. Mm-hmm. And it created this incredible sort of relay system from the depths of the ocean. It turns out that whale poop floats. So the phosphorus would be in the poop. And then you would have seabirds and salmon that would bring it to shore. and you have many other animals, and basically it's nature's way of recycling these nutrients.
And right, and it's global. It's this huge loop that goes all over the world. So, Bryn, that's all well and good, but we have this innate, you know, we're just disgusted by the smell, the look. Nobody wants to handle it unless they have a dog or a baby, you know. So how can we overcome this fear? We're afraid. We're afraid and disgusted by human waste. What do you think we could do to overcome that, to use it to our benefit?
Right. So I have an entire chapter in the book on the psychology of disgust. And you're right. It really is a big obstacle for us in many ways, because it's an evolved mechanism. There's a reason that we are so disgusted by certain things. Poop tends to be high on the list for many people. And the thinking is that it is an evolved mechanism to help keep us safe. So some people refer to it as a behavioral immune system. So things that you're very disgusted by, you tend to avoid. And the problem is that there's also side effects. And you can avoid things that really aren't dangerous, or, you know, are dangerous in one capacity, but actually quite useful in another. And so part of overcoming that is really understanding what's a true threat and what's something that it can actually be beneficial. So talking about it, educating people, making people aware of, you know, this is when it's useful, this is when it's dangerous, and this is what we're doing to try and reduce the burden of disease. You know, we have the technology to do that. So I think education can actually go a long way to making people more comfortable with the idea of poop is not this disgusting thing that makes us sick, but also when you transform it into something that can actually heal and can be very beneficial.
Yeah, so that leads us into what's really an important discovery. And I think in your book, you kind of say it's not just recent, but what is FMT as a medical treatment? And tell us more about that, because it is just fascinating.
Right. So I referred to that at the very beginning of the segment. And FMT stands for fecal microbiota transplant. And basically, it is transplanting someone's gut flora, their microbiome, that is out of balance with someone's healthy microbiome. Now, poop just happens to be the vehicle for these transplants. So you may be hearing this and thinking, that's gross. But actually, it is one of the most effective medical therapies that we know of for a particular type of infection caused by a bacteria. It's called Clostridioides difficile, or C. diff.
Yes, everybody who's gone to the hospital has heard about C. diff. And also, everybody possibly knows somebody that has, you know, irritable bowel syndrome or has Crohn's disease. And so this is it. So how has this evolved as a treatment?
Right. So this used to be considered kind of like a fringe therapy. And it was to the point where people were actually doing this as a home, you know, DIY therapy for many years. And then it finally became part of mainstream medicine. So this is really evolved to become, you know, a very important part of medicine for many people. And so you're basically taking the microbiome of a healthy donor, and you're then transplanting that into the patient. So this will technically be like a colonoscopy type procedure, or like a fecal enema, for example. And so, it sounds pretty crude, but if you think about it, what you're doing is you're basically sort of replanting a garden in a way, you know, a garden that maybe has become overcome with particular weeds. And instead, what you're doing is you're crowding out those weeds with healthy flora. And in this case, it's healthy microbes. So this has really kind of exploded and become not only a very important therapy for people with C. diff, But now researchers are exploring it for autoimmune conditions, so Crohn's and colitis, like you said. There are all kinds of clinical trials underway looking at its potential to send people into remission. So the potential here is really, really vast. I think, you know, what people are trying to do now is just make sure that they understand the science, because this is kind of a new paradigm of science, you know, because you're looking at this sort of rebalancing approach, ecology approach, and that's kind of new.
So it kind of started out with people trying to do it at home.
Yeah.
The mind boggles here. Some kind of enema or something?
That's exactly what happened. And part of this, and this goes back to the idea of disgust. And what happened was that some doctors were so disgusted by it, or thought it was this sort of quack or fringe therapy, that they refused to do it. And C. diff can be a deadly disease. People have died of it. The estimates are about 30,000 people in the United States every year, although that's probably a low estimate. And so at this point, you know, if someone has had this infection multiple times, you know, they're desperate and they're past the point of being disgusted, right? Mm-hmm. And so if they can find a healthy donor, you know, they will do a DIY therapy. Now, I want to make clear that I am not in any way suggesting that, because that can be very dangerous. You have to make sure that you are screening your donors appropriately, you know, to make sure that you're not inadvertently then transferring another disease or another condition.
I'm thinking now, like of this date, if you went to your local doctor or hospital, you should be able to find someone, especially in the Puget Sound area. You know,
Yes, this is solidly within mainstream medicine now, and the University of Washington Medical Center, among other medical centers, do offer this. Yes, and there actually is a nonprofit stool bank called Open Biome, and that really tried to help fill in the gaps, because, you know, there was a concern that there weren't enough of these transplants available for people who need them. So you know, there was literally a nonprofit startup to try and get very, very healthy donors to donate and then send that all over. And so far, they have sent it all over North America as well as many other countries.
Mm-hmm.
This is now very much, fortunately, you know, something that is much more available than it used to be.
You are listening to KPTZ, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. We're talking to Bryn Nelson, and he's the author of Flesh, Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. And we're right in the midst of talking about some really amazing health benefits of the human biome and the microbiology. And so it started out with kind of like a colostomy. No. What's the word I want, Bryn?
For the FMTs?
Yes.
Oh, you know, it'd be like a DIY, I guess like a colonoscopy procedure.
Yes, colonoscopy. That's right.
Or an enema.
Yeah. And now it's pill form. You can get it in pill form.
That's right. So one of the things that researchers have tried to do is in making this a little bit more, you know, palatable, is you can now do this as a triple-coated pill. Mm-hmm. And triple-coating is important because you do not want the contents to be released before their target. So medicine is, you know, trying a number of different things to try and balance the effectiveness with increased accessibility.
That's great.
And, you know, so that's the balance. Yeah.
Something else in your book that I was really fascinated by was new finds and new ways to study for archaeologists. And, you know, mm-hmm. we have to go beyond pyramids and finding Roman coins. And now we want to know more about, you know, pre-literate peoples and really what they ate. What diseases did they have, more about their lifestyle. So how does the study of fossilized human waste, is it fossilized, help with that? kind of research?
Some of it actually is fossilized, and it's called coprolites. There's a very fun story where archaeologists used to think that coprolites, or fossilized poop, from both humans and animals, was so worthless that at sites they would toss them like frisbees. And now they are among the most important artifacts that you will find at a site. And the reason for that is because they can tell you so much information about what that animal or what that individual human ate. Because within that, you know, fossilized a coprolite, or, you know, sometimes it's not yet fossilized, but, you know, it's a, maybe the contents of the latrine that go back to the medieval period. But you can find pollen, you can find other fragments of food, you can find sometimes parasitic worms. So you can tell, you know, their diet, you can talk about kind of their relative health. Sometimes you can help establish trade patterns so that if they're eating food that didn't grow naturally in that area, it will suggest some of the trading routes. And so, for example, in Denmark, I talked to an archaeologist, and her specialty is basically ancient latrines throughout the country, of which there are a surprising number that they have found. And they have been able to basically reconstruct the lifestyle of, for example, people in a Renaissance neighborhood in Copenhagen, mm-hmm. or in a Viking settlement, you know, somewhere, based on the content. So it's really become this very fascinating and very rich source of historical data.
Right, and finding out what the common people were all about. And so, you know, that's really important.
Yeah,
and women,
absolutely.
And what women were doing. Right, the cooking.
Yeah.
And now, jumping from archaeology into totally current information, we are using studies in the sewers, actually, of finding out about the spread of something like COVID-19. So how does, you know, taking samples from sewage work to help us understand what's happening with COVID-19?
Right. So this is called wastewater epidemiology, and you're basically using an environmental sentinel as a warning for public health.
Mm-hmm.
And so this actually dates back to the 1930s with polio, and they were able to find signs of polio in the sewers. And that was the first demonstration that this type of methodology actually worked. And so since then, they have used this for a wide number of different diseases, COVID-19 being the most recent one, but also even monkeypox. You can find evidence of that in the sewer. You can find evidence of antibiotic-resistant microbes in the sewer. So it's really become this very important and very sensitive monitor. And so I followed around a team in Tacoma, Washington, and they basically were looking at different points in the sewer network throughout the city. And based on where they were looking and what they were finding, they were able to say, here's where we have a burden of disease now, here's where, you know, we appear not to have it. So you can basically divide up a city into portions depending on the sewer network. You can even trace that back to single buildings, for example. So in some college campuses, they were actually able to do testing at the outlet, the sewer outlet of individual dorm buildings, to trace some of the outbreaks back to particular dorms, test the students in those dorms, and find asymptomatic infections, and then actually help avert outbreaks that way. So it can be a very, very effective a technology, but you have to have, you know, the infrastructure there in place to actually look for the signal.
Right. You know, when I think about it, and, you know, when we learned about kind of night soil in China and kind of looked with disgust, of course, at societies that reused and recycled human waste, you know, as your book closes, you start to talk about really globally, if we rethink the way we use, you know, our resources, we could really improve a lot of systems and a lot of situations. And so I'm going to ask you to read a little bit, and you can talk about, you know, the part that you're going to read from your book about the environment.
Sure. So this is from the last chapter. It's called Momentum. And I wanted to kind of circle back to the idea that we are not just consumers, but we're producers. And the idea that we're kind of the megafauna now, you know, and it's kind of up to us to help recycle these nutrients and kind of continue this pattern, you know, this age-old recycling system that nature has in place. And so kind of thinking about rejoining, you know, the rest of nature and putting our poop to good use. So this is a chapter basically about composting toilets. Imagine that you're a city worker living in an alternate version of today's Anthropocene. Your home and office buildings reach nearly 300 feet in height. No small feat, considering that they're made mostly of engineered wood. The buildings can make their own energy from the sun or wind or underground heat. They can gather their own water from rooftop rain and grow their own leafy greens. And when you poop in them, well, that's where things get interesting. A living building, one that works with nature to maximize the potential of natural daylight and solar power and fresh air and sustainable timber and rainwater, may have seemed like utopian fiction not so long ago. But skyscrapers made of renewable resources like laminated timber have sprouted up around the world. In 2019, Norway's 18-story Mosternet Tower of offices, apartments, a hotel, and a restaurant became the world's tallest wooden building. A plyscraper, some media dubbed it. By 2022, about 30 buildings had been fully certified by a separate movement called the Living Building Challenge that has pushed the construction industry to see how far it can go toward creating fully sustainable spaces that benefit the environment while promoting the health of their inhabitants. The buildings have the lifespan of a tree, are lit mainly by the sun, and exclude a long red list of toxic materials such as mercury, polyvinyl chloride, formaldehyde, and hormone-mimicking compounds. In Seattle, a six-story experiment called the Bullet Center was billed as the world's most self-sufficient office building when it opened its doors in 2013. And during the many public tours that followed, visitors invariably asked to see a bathroom. More than almost any other feature, the Bullet's bathroom seemed to elicit an overwhelming sense of curiosity among the urbanites. They wanted to know whether its 24 composting toilets, well, stank. They didn't, much to the surprise of nearly everyone who has been in an outhouse, and having helped my dad build one, I can confirm that odor control is often an ongoing concern. As one of the many features in the $32.5 million living building, the foaming toilets and 10 connected aerobic composters in its bowels use the output of office workers as the input for microbes and worms, taking an age-old idea and updating it for the 21st century. The final product, at least in principle, isn't just compost that can enrich the soil for gardens and environmental reclamation projects, but an enviable asset that may seem nearly unthinkable for a modern structure in the middle of a major city, Independence. Extensive power grids and sewer connections are normal parts of urban life for much of the Western world, where electricity travels along a convoluted network from power plants to transmission and distribution lines, and where we send our unwanted output hurtling through a miles-long odyssey of pipes. Wastewater treatment plants will continue to be necessary resource recovery plants. But what if, in parallel, we can create a more adaptable and nimble system that makes space for clusters of buildings with their own energy production and byproduct recycling systems that don't tax an aging infrastructure threatened by increasingly devastating natural disasters? I know what you're thinking. Seriously? Composting toilets? Yes. Seriously, beyond the gee whiz innovations of poop-fueled rocket ships and gold rushes that may create more apparent value, maybe true progress can be measured by the expanding reach of the deceptively simple composting toilet. I like to think of it as the love child of Bartleby the Scrivener and Jane Eyre, declaring that it would prefer not to do what's expected by post-industrial capitalism, and then achieving its own independence and sharing the wealth. It may not be a perfect vehicle for recapturing the value of poop, but its modern incarnation doesn't require a radical change in our behavior. Only a willingness to reconsider what's normal, what's valuable, and what's possible.
Oh, Bryn, that's really great. Thank you so much. I feel like saying, yes, we can. And with that, you have been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we've been talking to Bryn Nelson. He's the author of Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. And if you like reading the books of Mary Roach, you're going to really enjoy this one as well. I'd also, before I go, like to thank Carol McCreary of Flush, that's P-H-L-U-S-H, for standing for Public Hygiene, Lets Us Stay Human. Thank you, Carol, for introducing me to Bryn, and thank you, Bryn, again for joining us today. See you next time.
Today's closing music is Inner Light by Elderbrook with Bob Moses.
Like Doreen.